You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. In this podcast series, we bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. In 2007, the country of Estonia had the dubious honor of being the first victim of Russian state-sponsored cyber attacks. In today's episode, we'll hear from Thomas Ilves about that event and the impact that cyber warfare has on modern liberal democracies. Ilves was the president of Estonia from 2006 to 2016, and he spent this last academic year as the Bernard and Susan Liatode Distinguished Visiting Fellow at FSI's Center for International Security and Cooperation.
How I got into this, I mean, the short-term thing is that basically, if you read any history of cyber war, it always begins with Estonia, because up till 2007, while there was a 30-year history of hacking, or maybe 35-year history of hacking, and this is maybe one of the points that is really sort of underlying what I, the specifics that I talk about, is that the cyber world, or just sort of digital processes, were not used to achieve negative political ends. And I would say 2007, when we were swamped with cyber attacks, which never got into any servers but basically kept them all offline, was the first time you saw sort of the Clausewitzian, the continuation of policy by other means. Before that, there was a famous hack of the U.S. Department of Defense called Moonlight Maze in the 90s. But this was not covert. This was like you're going to be punished. And since then, we've seen all kinds of attacks like that. But this was the first, and it was also what made me focus much more, so 11 years ago, or 10 years ago actually this month, on cybersecurity issue rather than all of the sort of the happy talk that I'd been talking all along about digitization and how good it is. And why I do what I do, to go way back, is that because as the child of refugees, I started, foreign security policy became important to me about age 8, when I tried to figure why the hell I was living in the United States, and why I speak the way I do. But they were refugees, and I figured, well, what happened? And the first thing was like, what is Russia doing? Later on, that grew into like, what is it? What is democracy, which is, should be the main topic today. And then I had this amazing thing, which luck or a serendipity of a math teacher decided in a one-off to teach a bunch of 14-year-old kids how to code, and that stayed with me for the rest of my life. And which later on, when Estonia became independent, the first thing I tried to push through was computerizing all the schools with the same sort of experience in mind. But anyway, to talk about what I'm talking about, sort of the topic, my fundamental thesis is that we really, the past 10 years and developments in digitization have changed the nature of the electoral process in ways that we are only now beginning to fully recognize. It is not simply a matter of what happened last year in the United States, because even before what happened last year in the United States, we saw already politically motivated hacks into the Bundestag, or the German parliament, into German think tanks, political think tanks. In Germany, you have each party has its own think tank. What all of this means, it's hard to fathom. And what makes it especially difficult for me right now is that every day there's something new that comes out in this. It's not even scholarly. This is journalism. Just this afternoon, about an hour ago, when I was at my first seminar on this, which is an all-day thing called Democracy and Digitization, but was only focused only on social media, trying to figure out what to do with Facebook and Twitter in this new era. I was just sitting there, it got a little boring, and suddenly this news item came in which which I think is kind of groundbreaking, which is that the German FBI, the Bundesverfassungsschutz, is so worried about a repeat of what happened in the United States, even though they've already been hacked, but I mean, if this stuff starts being instrumentalized, quote the head of the, I mean, the sort of the German Richard Comey, "We believe it is necessary that we are in a position to wipe out these servers if the providers and owners of the servers are not ready to ensure they are not used to carry out attacks." This is the first time ever that I have seen a declaration of offensive intent in the cyber world. I mean, offensive capability is something we know for decades to exist, and we know that offensive capabilities have been used against, our countries. But none of our countries would ever say that we would use or have used offensive capabilities until yesterday at the press conference by the German FBI. So this is, I mean, this shows people are getting worried. And again, we have the discussion in the United States, for obvious reasons, but really has focused on the sort of what happened in the lead up to and during the U.S. elections, forgetting that the same processes are going on in other liberal democracies, where maybe you could say ultimately that the French were most concerned right now, and the Germans were also very concerned, are maybe a step ahead because they've been forewarned. But people are getting worried all over about what could be done and what could happen. And so, and the other point I would say is that some of the solutions that have already been proposed, not here, but in, say, for example, Germany, put into direct conflict some of the basic pillars of liberal democracy. I mean, the pillar we all talk about, of course, mostly, is the electoral process, free and fair elections. With what we have seen now in the past year or so, and we see another pillar, which is the fundamental respect for fundamental rights and freedoms, especially freedom of expression, coming into conflict with this, most notably in a law, or rather a bill that is currently before the German parliament, that would, in the case of fake news, fine platforms up to 50 million euros or $55 million per instance of fake news. Now, I mean, I don't know whether this will go through, it's in debate, but it shows you the level of anxiety, and this is a bill proposed by the Ministry of Justice in Germany, or I guess the equivalent of the Attorney General's office in the U.S., for a new law. And so this tension between freedom of speech and maintaining the integrity of the electoral process is a tension that we will be facing for a while. Now, to try to put it into sort of general perspective, and basically, I mean, democracies have always been challenged. They've always had people who don't like democracies, and there have been all kinds of wars over it. But the technology up till now has not been used so effectively to subvert the foundations of liberal democracy, at least insofar as we've known it since the Enlightenment and its enshrinement in the U.S. Constitution and the French sort of égalité, liberté, égalité, fraternité, and the idea of the rights of man. And also, you could even say, because 2 days ago was the anniversary, the Polish Constitution of 1787, which was a very democratic, modern liberal constitution. It didn't last for long because they were invaded by the Russians immediately, but that's one of the problems. But again, if we take as a starting point that the electoral free and fair elections, and then secondly that due process or rule of law, and to basically sort of guarantee the rights of the minority against the tyranny of the majority, to use, I guess, Thomas Jefferson's phrase, and then the fundamental rights and freedoms we associate with liberal democracy. But these, one way or another, will, I predict, unfortunately, be circumscribed to a certain degree in order to at least guarantee the fundamental decision process that underlies democracy, is that the people, the ultimate sovereigns, decide who will get the baton to be on the other side of the Lockean sort of contract between the people and the government. Free and fair elections generally have been free from outside interference. In fact, democratic elections, because it's so good and so important, that even illiberal regimes have staged free and fair elections. I mean, they don't really turn out that way. I mean, you know, Vladimir Putin, the last presidential elections in Rostov on Don, got 132%. But they all want to have elections. The problem is, you know, how free and fair are they? Who counts the votes? And it is the gold standard. I mean, even for countries or regimes that are hardly democratic, but they all want to say they have free and fair elections. And the question is, where is a genuinely free and fair election going? In this process that we first saw last year, but we already saw things starting up in Europe, I've tried to separate five attack vectors. How are liberal democracies under attack? We have here in the post U.S. election period spent a lot of time looking at, or talking about, or listening to discussions on fake news and whether or not they had an effect. And this day-long seminar I was just at focus strictly on the responsibility of social media in terms of fake news. But I would argue that that's just part of it. And we really, if you want to look at what the different, what is going on with elections and manipulation of liberal democratic states, it's a whole range of things. And we shouldn't be focusing just on one thing, but try to look at it more broadly. Just as the adversary country, at least the current adversary country in this regard, Russia does. There's a March 2013 article by the chief of staff of the Russian military, General Valery Gerasimov, who has a very famous article on hybrid war. Which unfortunately has been largely taken in sort of military security policy discussions as meaning little green men, which basically are people who are special operations forces who don't wear insignia and then do nasty things. But if you actually read the article, I mean, it's the whole gamut, the whole range of possible things to do to get a positive outcome in conflict. And the digital side of this is largely not at all violent or military. I mean, and up till sort of the past year, discussions of cyber, or as Donald Trump would say, the cyber, have focused on actually the physical or kinetic effects, potential kinetic effects of cyber attacks. You know, basically, and you know this far better than I, that it's like, what happens if they take out the electrical grid? What happens if they, you know, whatever? I mean, there are all kinds of things you can do. Blow up a power plant. I mean, the there have been cases of that. In Ukraine, a power plant has been subjected to a debilitating cyber attack twice. The U.S. Managed to, using Stuxnet, go after the Nauruz, or whatever is it, the...
Natanz?
Whatever. The, what are the plutonium enrichment plant in Iran. Again, that's causing physical damage. What I think is going on now is a realization that you actually don't... You don't need to have a military attack to get your way. And this is, you know, this is either... I mean, it's either ancient Chinese, what's his name, Sun, right? Or it's Clausewitz, but basically, why would you bother having to build up a huge military to fight NATO if you can get NATO to fall apart, if you can get France, as Marine Le Pen advocates, to step out of NATO, or if the U.S., get the U.S. to say that NATO is obsolete. I mean, why would you have to do that? Well, you have to fight a war. You can, and so if you can get governments, liberal democratic governments, to adopt very different policies without having to either fight a war, lose people, spend a lot of money, and deal with the costs of maintaining territory you've conquered, I mean, you can just get them to be nice to you. Besides, there's an additional benefit to getting liberal democratic countries to follow your sort of security policy desires, which is that they're rule of law countries. So you can still, I mean, to be very cynical, you can continue to launder your money there, because no one wants to keep their money in Russia, because it may be taken any time. But if you get it out there, somewhere to London, for example, or New York, or real estate owned by some rich person in New York, for example, I mean, then your money's safe. So you don't want to actually go to war. And there's a lot of motivation for doing this, to actually use other softer means to get people to do what you want. As I said, I sort of tried just to give a typology of where, of how these things work. I've identified five. I don't claim that these are exhaustive. And they do overlap in many areas, but they're different. And the most obvious one is given the term hacking. And hacking means breaking into somebody's server. The term is unfortunately absurdly overused, and you know, you talk about hacking the election, which is maybe a useful metaphor, but basically breaking into a computer system or a server. Unfortunately, as we've seen, that while this, there are very sophisticated techniques for doing this, and if you know the term, you know, zero-day exploit, I mean, there are all kinds of great things you can do, or wonderful things, or highly sophisticated things you can do, but actually, most of what we've seen in the political realm, I mean, I can't say all, but it seems almost all of the kinds of attacks or break-ins have been simply due to the what I argue is the completely obsolete system of computer security we have, which is dates back to the late 70s, early 80s, of basically your email address and a password. All passwords are just, you know, you can force a password. That's the way where it is today. The system worked fine in 1983. I was on BitNet, which was like this academic network. And there were 3,500 people on this, and they would discuss research. Couldn't even send papers at the time. Now there are 4.2 billion people on the internet, told me Jared Cohen last week. And whatever worked for 3,500 academics who generally don't engage in cyber war doesn't work in this environment. And lo and behold, what have we seen? The breaking into servers, be they the Democratic National Committee server, or in fact, as FBI Director Comey sort of stated, they also broke into the Republicans. the difference I'll get to later. But they've gotten into the basically political parties in Europe. They've got their servers. They've gotten into the parliaments of countries in Europe, most notably and most offensively, at least the people making the most noise about it, at the Bundestag in Germany, and that for a long time and multiple times. They've got into the Germany, they have the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung and the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, which are the two main party think tanks. I guess it's kind of like AEI here and, I don't know, the Project for a New America in the U.S. I mean, they're sort of politically oriented think tanks, and very successfully. Now, that kind of breaking in is avoidable. You can use, in the case of the DNC, according to David Sanger of the New York Times, there were 126 people who had access to the DNC server. 124 of them used what you have here at Stanford, which is two-factor authentication. Two people didn't access the server through 2FA, but rather went directly into it in the sort of standard address password system. Guess which two were used by the Russians to go in there? So, I mean, that's 2FA or two-factor authentication, which you have to use here and everyone grumbles about, doesn't give you complete security because there are always other ways of doing it. Basically, it really raises the threshold to a level in which they really want to have to go after you to get into your server. But if they just sort of casually want to go in and steal stuff, then it keeps that out. And that has been, as far as we can tell, that has been what all of these people, the U.S. Congress and the other ones, have not used is 2FA. The Bundestag did not use 2FA. So even as cumbersome as your system is here, which I do agree is quite cumbersome compared to other ones, like the one we have in my country, it gives you security to a degree. We in Estonia, by the way, call it 1.5 factor security because you get something over a mobile device. And that, as has now been shown just recently, you can just figure it out. SMSs are hackable, are hacked. And so what you get in the mobile phone plus computer system that you use here, most people have, it's not quite two-factor authentication. Real 2FA, you need a chip. And so we, in my country, have used the chip card since 2001. But to show the problem of sort of lack of care on security, I just read a few weeks ago that the U.S. Congress has chip cards. Now, if you're in government, if you're in the State Department, or DOD, you do use a chip card to authenticate yourself. The U.S. Congress does not have a chip on the card, but they have a little sticker that makes it look like it has a chip. I'm not kidding. So and how do they do this? I'm sure all of you have gotten spear phishing attacks, which is that you get a message from your bank or from Google or from Apple or whatever, PayPal, and saying, you know, there's a problem. You need to re-enter your data, your password. I get about three of them a day. I always click up. It says Apple, for example, and then I look at the address, and it's some ridiculous address that it could no way be Apple, and I just trash those. But the point is that these things are very common, and people very often will go and click on these things and actually enter their password data. Which then enables things such as the hack to the DNC. And so I mean, this is, it's not only political parties. And I would just tell everyone here, always check any mail you get that would ask you to re-enter your data or your password to see where it's coming from. And is it, 10 minutes, I just started. Okay, I'll speed up. All right, so that's how they get it. The next thing where...
I think people want to talk, want to get your answers to their questions.
Okay. The where it gets... 40 minutes, 20 minutes from there. All right.
For a former president, you get 20.
Back in the old days, they didn't limit what my time at all.
This has been a coup.
See, Harold, now I'm in trouble with Harold, so...
All right, where it gets different and what it is a phenomenon which generally carries the name of doxing, which is actually publishing what you steal. Because understandably, you want to go, I'm going to speak fast, if I have problems missing me, then tell me. You want to steal information, that's standard espionage. You want, say someone, the French want to know what the Republicans are saying inside, what are the Democrats saying inside, they might hack into your thing. Doxing is a new level of stuff, sort of attack. And this is where the difference is between the Democrats and the Republicans. That said, the Russians got into the Republicans, we know from Comey, but they did not publish the information that they got there. And WikiLeaks did that, as it turns out, subsequently via servers located, WikiLeaks servers in Russia. And let's face it, I mean, every one of us somewhere in our computer files has said something that we'd rather not the wider public know. So if you've ever had a fight or whatever, that's, you really don't want people to see that. And so they publish these things. And, of course, this had huge effects on public opinion. The big debate that continues, and we will never know, is whether that, in fact, affected the election. But certainly it became the topic for a while, twice, actually. First time when these mail emails were published, and then once when later on it again happened with John Podesta. And this is direct manipulation already of the public rather than simply going in and sort of following what was going on. What I find interesting is actually this kind of attack is the reaction of the media, which is that there was an earlier break-in of the DNC. It happened in 1972 at the Watergate Hotel. No one managed to steal anything because the guys were caught, but even if they'd gotten something, I guess most likely they would have only used it for sort of as in an espionage form because they probably would have feared ever to publish something that was stolen goods. And I think the media response would have been very different had they even gone that far to leak stuff that would have been stolen goods. Whereas in the case of the DNC hacks, the media went sort of appealing to the cliques that are based on the voyeurism of all of us. Being focused on the content of the stolen, or to be used the Edgar Allan Poe term, purloined letters. I mean, if you ever read in high school English the Edgar Allan Poe story, purloined letter, where it was used for blackmail, or was threatened to be used for blackmail. The media, some of the media, New York Times, Washington Post, later on issued mea culpas that they had, in fact, maybe we should have focused a little more on the fact of the robbery rather than the content. But it is illustrative of a larger problem we have, is that we don't take stuff seriously if we don't see it. We're all empiricists at heart. And so, if you have a physical break-in with physical evidence, then we're horrified. If it's digital, then we go, oh boy, what does it say in there? And this is it's a whole different topic, it's a whole different essay, because I think it affects a lot of things that we do, that we don't take, we don't understand that what happens digitally is ultimately no different from what happens in the physical world. I would say this is more broadly a problem of security, is that we are tremendously afraid of kinetic effects, bombs, tanks, whatever. But we kind of like don't take as seriously things that if they're just electrons. Okay, so I'll go on. From doxing as a technique, we move on to a new level, which is, I would say, is the massive propagation of fake news. I would say false news, just because the term fake news has been politicized so much and sort of has so many multiple layers of political meaning. But I mean, fake news or false news has been around for a while. I mean, you could say, the serpent and Adam and Eve, or you could say, the Trojan horse were cases of, in the Aeneid, actually, where it's in, but Cassandra runs around saying they didn't go, and don't take that horse in. And they said, oh no, they left, and everything's wonderful. And then the Trojans brought the horse in, and we know the rest. So fake news is not new, but its use and its instrumentalization and the efficacy with which it was used in last year's election and as it has is being used this very day, talking about Emmanuel Macron being a homosexual and being is something that is unprecedented. The Soviet Union used fake news. One of the classic cases is the story that the CIA invented AIDS. In about 1983-84, there was a story published originally in a communist newspaper in a very provincial sort of backwater of India that then, through help, sort of made its way up the food chain until it appeared in major European newspapers, especially those that were somewhat more anti-American. But it never really got any traction. What we have seen now is technologically enabled, technologically and humanly enabled massive spread of fake news. When I say technologically enabled, there are robots that send out fake news. To the degree that a Stanford graduate, who is now a University of Washington professor, Kate Starbird, found that with a recent fake news story called, which had the hashtag Syria hoax, which started immediately after the first reports of the sarin attack 2 months ago, that were retweeted every 5 seconds to different addresses. There were no human beings behind this, and you can always spot a Twitter bot, which would be something a little bit obnoxious, and you look at what the address is of the person 5 minutes, okay, very fast. It has a name, usually it has a picture of a nubile woman, and then it has some name like Katya, and then it has like this long, like 10-digit number there. It's analogous to the spear phishing. But these things get retweeted. There is the human side as well, in which people voluntarily do so on Facebook. On Twitter, you can robotize these things. On Facebook, it's more difficult. But other statistics show that last year, in the 3 months before the election, the U.S. election, there were 8.7 million voluntary shares of fake news. There were 7.3 million shares of real news. People themselves enabled this. Why they do that, well, I'll get to it in the last 2 minutes of this. Then we can open up. And if you add to that, that at least in the United States, as of last July, according to Pew, there's all kinds of studies, for 62% of Americans, the fundamental source of their news is Facebook. People rely on Facebook to get their news. So if you put these numbers together, you see that massive numbers of people were spreading fake news, and their friends would get these news items. Since their friends sent it to them, they believe it. These things again distort the standard democratic process. I could talk a lot about this, but I won't because I only now have 4 minutes, and then I will get to the. But I mean, the effects can be tragic or near tragic. Again, the best known case is of what is called Pizzagate, where this slightly deranged guy in West Virginia read or heard that that John Podesta, the campaign manager for Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton were running in the basement of a family pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C., a pedophile ring. And he got an AR-15 and drove to Washington and shot up the restaurant. So, you know, this information can have real effects. No one was fortunately hurt, but in any case, this is a real phenomenon we have to deal with. And then we come to what is only now, I mean, on a daily basis, is being kind of figured out what's going on because we don't quite understand it. But it's the use of big data analytics in the electoral process to directly target people based on profiles of their personality, their socioeconomic status, their race, gender, whatever. I mean, there is a huge amount of data about each of us out there, and it is used and sold. I mean, if you have an app, a free app, I would say there's no such thing as a free app because the world is not full of app developers or good Samaritans that just think it's a great idea to develop an app. I mean, you are basically the product. You are monetized. Your data are monetized. And monetized, someone's selling these data. And you can buy it. And in fact, as a result, you can develop a very, very granular, precise profile of people. They don't know who you are. So it's not as if they're, it's not like the deep state that's, or the surveillance state that's following you. But algorithms do it. And they match up all of the stuff, and that yields a picture of a person who, you know, a person who is a 33-year-old black mother of two living in a part of town that is, you know, doing somewhat better but has whatever concerns. That, and then an algorithm generates that picture, and then another algorithm generates a message to that, and then that ends up as what is called a dark ad, which are ads in Facebook, which the rest of the world doesn't see, but it's a targeted ad toward you particularly, or people who are very much like you, that has been algorithmically derived, and they were used to huge effect by the side of the Trump administration the Trump campaign. The Democrats were far behind in this, but I bet so this company that did this, which is called Cambridge Analytica, which maybe oversells its claims for its ability to do data. 1 minute. I predict next election in the U.S., the Democrats will have someone just as good. They can't use the name Oxford Analytica because it's already taken, but there'll be some other big data company that will do the same kind of stuff. So, but I mean, if you think about what does that mean? It's the party platforms, ads, and sort of television, mass communication is kind of, it's in the past. It's no longer used. It's kind of like 8-track tapes, if you're old enough to remember what those are. I mean, no one uses them anymore because you can now do political ads directly targeting people. It was used in the Brexit campaign. Where it will go from here, who knows? But in any case, my main point is that after what we've seen in the past 10 years and what we've seen especially in the last year and a half has altered the nature of electoral democracy, and the solutions to it, which I'll get to now that my minute is up, I'll discuss in the Q&A. But basically, we already have legislative proposals in Europe that I think personally are very close to limiting freedom of speech one way or another. Since I was talking to all these Facebook and Google and other Twitter people today, is that I think that Europe will respond far more forcefully. They already have or are forcefully responding. And, you know, given the basic A, anti-Americanism that is sort of, you know, everywhere there somewhere in the body politic, and secondly, a huge resentment, especially in France and Germany, of the technological preponderance of the United States. 95% of cloud services in Europe are American companies. And finally, this a hypersensitivity that we already saw during in the aftermath of Snowden towards privacy intrusions, I think will lead Europe to take a really tough stance on social media and the other stuff. Well, I don't know what the response should be or would be. Anyway, so I can, from now on, I'll do the rest of my talk in trying to sort of weasel my answers into your questions.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thanks for listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford or visit our website at fsi.stanford.edu for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.